I can have everyone's attention for just a minute. I'd like to welcome everyone to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series. We have a span of attendees here ranging from Mr. Bob Berman, who's been coming faithfully for 30-plus years, to some first-time visitors. And it's great to see particularly the first-timers and newcomers. And for those of you new to us, I think you'll find that this is a relatively unique organization in that we've been at this, for 30 years plus in the same format. Not exactly the same location. We've moved around that a few times. And we are entirely all volunteer and entirely nonprofit. And we have really no point of view or worldview to kind of promote other than the idea that it's really a good thing for people to come and be exposed to all sorts of different thinkers and get a chance to dialogue with them. So we try to provide the widest array of experiences we can. We don't try to screen for coherence to any kind of particular worldview or anything like that. We just want interesting people to come talk to us. And we take up a $5 donation or $2 for students, and that helps defray our expenses. We encourage you to eat at El Phoenix, so they'll continue to give us the room, and tip your waitstaff because they work hard. And be sure you settle up when you leave, because occasionally somebody forgets that, and that comes out of our treasury and is really an unbudgeted expense. So we prefer not to pick that up. And if you want to be a regular, we've got a 6-month subscription deal. That's a little over half price, almost a half price deal. If you want to become a regular subscriber, we'll have a lecture about 45 minutes to an hour, and then we'll have half an hour of Q&A, so you can kind of hold your questions till the end. And we'll recognize questioners, try to give everybody a chance to ask a question before we go back the second time to somebody. And we do ask that you, sort of the opposite of our Jeopardy game we're going to have, we ask that you phrase your question in the form of a question rather than as a discourse, because it's Q&A, it's not A&A. So with that housekeeping out of the way, we'll proceed to the delights of the evening. We have as our speaker tonight Skip Kilmer, who, as they say in sports radio, is a longtime attendee, first-time presenter here at Dallas Philosophers Forum. But he retired from the faculty of Green Hill School here in Dallas, where you served for how many years in the faculty?
35
years on the faculty of Green Hill, and taught physics and other science courses, and survived both of the drum kids coming through. So I know he's pretty tough. Skip is going to speak to us tonight on supermodels, our quest to explain the nature of reality and the reality of nature.
You're on.
All right. I did teach science for quite a while at a little school over in Addison, and over my 35 years I taught everything from 6th grade general science to college level advanced placement physics, and all the kind of science courses they have between those. One of the most interesting things I did the last few years was with another teacher, a social science teacher. We put together a course called The History and Philosophy of Science that was fun. And so what I'm going to do with you tonight in 45 minutes is give you that semester-long course. So, one of these images is a scientific supermodel, but the other one plays one on TV. That works. Reality is a lot more complicated and chaotic than we can perceive, and so how do we make sense of it? Well, we've got to take what we're given, and with imperfect information, try to figure out what underlies that information. What I'm going to be talking about here, nobody got it. What I'm going to be talking about here is scientific models, which I've kind of defined for you here. There are all kind of scientific models. Some of them are words, some of them are pictures, some of them are actual structures that somebody might build, and I'll show you some of all of these, but that they share certain features with natural phenomena. One of the things you try not to do is to overstretch the model. You don't want to take it too far. No model completely is analogous to the stuff that you're studying. One of my favorite philosophers down here, that be a finger pointing at the moon. Don't mistake the moon, the finger for the moon. So, if we don't know everything, how can we understand anything? Models are necessarily incomplete. What scientists say is that they're reductionists. They only have certain features of the stuff that you study. Because nature is infinitely complex, interconnected in too many ways for the human brain to fully comprehend. And the models can range from the placement of a few monoliths around Stonehenge to millions of lines of code in a climate model, climate simulation. They're usually limited in scale. For example, if you can make a water molecule out of things like Tinker Toys, but it's not going to be wet. Models don't predict everything. They're necessarily tentative if they're scientific. We must be willing to abandon them or modify them or adapt them whenever more accurate or contradictory data show up. So there's a couple of ways that we've approached this, what do we do if we don't know everything? Myths are useful. They provide easily understandable stories, simple if somewhat far-fetched explanations. They provide group cohesiveness and identity, and this may be the most important characteristic of myths. They provide continuity because they evolve slowly in terms of human lifetimes. As far as anthropologists can figure out, every human culture that ever existed had a creation myth that identified the important parts, aspects of that culture. Their dogmatic inflexibility can bring comfort and security, but it can also limit progress. Scientific models, on the other hand, trade dogmatic rigidity for scope and for accuracy. The process itself, generalization, prediction, and testing, provides the utility and the relevance of science and keeps it more and more accurate, sort of Bayesian. Our distant ancestors were first gatherers roaming the savannas in Africa. And compared to the other creatures of the day, they had better vision, better hearing than most, but they had a poor sense of smell. What they did have was a brain big enough to carry mental maps of their environments. And they turned this pattern-making power to the sky and to their own imaginations. And here's a couple of patterns that they and we see in the sky. This is actually the same constellation. On the left is the Orion that if you go out and look at the sky you're familiar with, it's up tonight. On the right, it's the same constellation, but it's upside down. Here, for example, is the stars in the Orion Nebula, the stars in what we call the Sword of Orion. This is called the Hand, and this is the way the Aborigines and Australians saw the same constellation. Of course, if you're in Australia, you know, you're standing like that, so the same constellation is upside down. Okay. Our ancestors were above average size, and they had relatively poor offensive and defensive capabilities compared to the other African mammals of the time. Their rapidly expanding brains, however, overcame physical weakness by developing language and fire, and tools, and weapon, and they began to question what their senses were telling them. And here might be a series of questions that they could have been asking each other themselves. They hear rustling in the grass. Is it dangerous? Is it food? Is it something I need to worry about? Is the grass itself doing the rustling? Is the grass alive? Or is the wind that I feel doing the rustling? Can it rustle the grass? And if so, is the wind alive? And then they might have gone a little bit beyond just these, you know, I see or I hear something, what is it, to something longer term. They noticed that if you plant a seed of a plant, that what grows up is something that looks like that plant. Well, suppose you have a loved one that dies and you bury him. Is there some chance he's going to rise up then and be another Jerry or whoever? Philosophers like Plato, I skipped one. As our species evolved, this pattern and mapping ability led us to wonder whether the world we experience is a manifestation of underlying abstract structure, even purpose. Mental models became the birth of philosophy. So here's Plato. His theory of forms, I'm sure most of you are familiar with this, is the idea that there's a chair, and there's a different chair, and there's a whole lot of things that we could look at, and we could call them chairs, even though they may have very little in common other than you can sit on them. But there's somewhere out there in the realm of reality, the form chair, and everything that we see here has chairness. So that's what they all have in common, and each one of them is an imperfect model of that chair. He also had another analogy that he pulled out from time to time. Plato's cave, you've probably all seen sketches like this. If you haven't, let me remind you that you have this cave and you have some prisoners down here that are strapped to the floor and they're watching shadows on the wall in front of them. The shadows may be cast by somebody back here with puppets doing various things and the fire behind them casting the shadows on the wall. Or they may be sunlight coming in from outside and shadows from things going on outside. And everything they know is based on these shadows, which are simply part of what reality is. And they've got to interpret these shadows in such a way that they know what's going on out in the world or what's going on in these puppeteers' play, whatever it is. So with imperfect data, they were able to create, to fill in the blanks, to some fairly sophisticated things, especially in the classical period there. Philosophers like Plato, that sounds familiar, attempted to find easily visualized connections between the complex world that we experience and the relatively simple models that showed up in, for example, geometry. You may know that there are five regular solids, things that have the same face on every side and the same angles on every side. And so they equated those in some way that I've never quite understood to the five elements of the earth. You've got the air, the water, the fire, and so forth. Exactly how this model worked, like I say, has always been kind of a mystery to me, but it made sense to them. And then the sphere, which is the perfect solid, is in the middle, and that takes up, that's the whole universe. Another one that makes a little bit more sense is if you have something that's kind of mysterious. For example, here's the earth. We've known it was round essentially 3,000 years. It was actually measured about 2,200 years ago. But on the surface of the earth, we have these folds, these mountain ranges, and parts that are lower and parts that are higher. And we knew that the weather and climate and so forth erodes these things. So how is it that they're still there? How we have these nice, sharp mountain peaks? And so they noticed that if you have a fruit like an apple, and as it dries, it shrinks, and as it shrinks, the skin doesn't fit it particularly well, and it wrinkles up, and it creates patterns very much like the patterns that they saw on the earth. So the model that they're making here is, for some reason, the earth is shrinking. Well, maybe it's cooling off. We know that the earth is warm, and there's volcanoes and things. And if that's cooling the earth off, then the earth would shrink, then the skin wouldn't fit, and it would wrinkle up. And that model really persisted for a long time and really was only supplanted when in the 1960s and 70s when plate tectonics kind of took over. We had a model that fit the data a little bit better. The earth is actually not shrinking, of course. It's growing at the rate of 100 tons a day or so, things falling on. So the earth is modeled by the apple. I suppose you might say the apple's modeled by the earth if you were fruit grower. Okay. Descartes was big into duality, and let me kind of give you an idea of what we mean by that if you're not fully aware. Our awareness of the seemingly free will of action in ourselves suggests that events have causes, and causes have causers. And so then could all of nature be subject to similar processes of animation and purpose? And so we had this animism where everything is assumed to have, in some sense, the kind of consciousness that we feel. A tree might wave its branches for some reason other than there's just wind blowing by. And a tree might
drop a limb on somebody walking by because he made the tree god angry somehow. And, you know, there's all kind of stories that you can make up about things that are happening in nature. Well, if you have these things inhabited by spirits, maybe some of these spirits are pretty powerful, and they're responsible for things like volcanic eruptions and hurricanes that come through and tornadoes that wipe out the village and so forth. And if there are creatures, unseen creatures, that have that kind of power, maybe we can influence them somehow to act on our behalf, to bring us in a good crop instead of a hailstorm. And there's several ways we can do that. And the last one, and this is where we kind of get to Descartes, is if there's this spirit world and this physical world, well, maybe our consciousness is something that inhabits us, the spirit, the soul, the whatever it is that inhabits us, rather than just a product of, you know, chemical things going on in our brains. So this is the duality idea, and it still persists. You still hear people that fully expect that model to be the right one. Okay, back into classical science again, back in the Plato, Aristotle's days. This one is a picture of sort of a mix of the mythological aspects and the scientific aspects of what I'm talking about. We have down at the bottom, below our feet, corruption. And then as you rise up, you have more and more pure and light elements. These were the classical elements. You have the earth just below our feet. You have the water that is floating on top of the earth. You have the air that bubbles up through the water and goes up. Those are the elements. You can have compounds like a stick of wood. You put a stick in the fire and light the end of it. What you see is this flame where the wood is coming apart. Basically, it's forming the fire, which is leaving, and you can see the smoke rising up. If you put a piece of metal in that smoke, you see water condense on it, so there must have been water in the wood. After the fire and the air and the water are all gone, what's left is the ash, which is the earth part of the wood. So everything then is assumed to be compounded from these four simple elements. Quintessence, of course, the fifth element is the perfect perfection in the heavens. So again, a mix of kind of scientific part right in here with mythological part out there. There's less evidence for that kind of thing. The four-element theory, it was a good one. It lasted a long time, explained a lot of things. We were able to make metals believing this sort of thing out of, you know, rocky ores. So it wasn't a bad theory. It lasted a long time, served its purpose. Another nested spheres. When we turned our eyes to the skies, we noticed that there are what we call the fixed stars, things that are always there. They may change with the season, but every time you see them, they look the same. They're in the same relationship. But there's these other things that float around, move back and forth, get bright and dim and so forth. We call those the planets. And so what we envisioned was that there was this concentric set of crystalline spheres. And the planets were riding around on these spheres, and the spheres would each rotate at some speed, and that carried the planets around. And that was a pretty good model, but it wasn't great, because the planets didn't rotate around very regularly. Sometimes they moved forward through the sky, sometimes they moved backwards, sometimes they were brighter, which meant they were closer to us, sometimes they were dimmer, must be farther away. And so Ptolemy was an Egyptian from Phoenicia, I think, put what he called epicycles, which is another smaller sphere, this one, for example, with Mars, which rode around on the big one. And as it rode around, it also rotated like this, so that sometimes it was going backwards, sometimes it was closer to us, sometimes it was farther away. So the epicycles explained a lot of the flaws in motion that the simple spheres by themselves really couldn't show. Notice that it's Earth-centered, which makes perfect sense because the Earth is stationary. We are sitting down here and we don't fall off or anything. Not a bad model at all. And Ptolemy and people like that actually built physical models of this, which worked pretty well, but not perfectly. And so, over time, embarrassing. Thought I turned you off. Excuse me. A guy named Copernicus, a Polish monk, had a different idea, what we call a paradigm shift. And he saw that by taking the Earth out of the center of the universe and replacing it with the Sun, you could simplify the model quite a bit. You no longer needed the epicycles to show backward and forward motion. For example, as the Earth passed Mars in its orbit, Mars would appear to be going backwards, just as if you're driving down the freeway and pass somebody, when you look out the window, they look like they're going backwards to you. Also, if we're on the same side of the Sun as Mars is, it's pretty close to us. If we're on the other side of the Sun from Mars, it's farther away and therefore dimmer. So this was able to explain, without the addition of epicycles, which were just kind of an ad hoc modification that kind of cluttered up the model of Ptolemy, you didn't need that anymore. This was simpler. Now, while it was simpler, while it explained things perhaps a little better, it also created its own problems. If the Earth is whizzing around in space, why don't we fall off? And if the Earth is whizzing around in space, why don't we feel the wind blowing by as we're doing it? Ptolemy, or Copernicus, didn't really have an explanation for that. And he said, basically, to the folks in charge back then, this is only a model. This is just a trick I use to be able to explain and predict things a little more accurately than what Ptolemy could do with his model. We don't have to really believe that the Sun is there and we're all rotating around it. Okay. The Enlightenment is often spoken of as our greatest attempt to unite the data-driven ideas of science with the socially driven ideas of religion. An underlying premise of this union is expressed in the first two quotes, which essentially say the same thing. They're often called Occam's Razor. William of Occam is the second one. And the quest at first was to more closely grasp just how God accomplished his aims. And eventually, the rule of parsimony implied that the simplest explanations, which is what they want to find, rarely require supernatural intervention. And the natural sciences and the social science gradually drifted apart then. On to Galileo. He was an early proponent of the supremacy of observation over authority. And he was willing to challenge old accepted ideas, even when they went back to Aristotle's like these do. He did a lot of his work in the lab, but a lot of it was what was called thought experiments, which theoretical scientists are always doing. And it works basically like this. Suppose you have a light object and a heavy object. Everybody knows that the heavy object falls faster than the light object. It's just one of the laws of nature. Heavy things fall faster than light things. If that's true, Galileo reasoned, suppose you tied a heavy object to a light object. Would you then create a heavier object which would fall faster, or would the light object create a drag on the heavy object, slowing it down? So you've got the same model producing a contradiction. And generally speaking, when that happens, there's probably something wrong with your model. And so to figure out if either one of these two things or something else was true, Galileo went into the lab. And here's a couple of the experiments that he performed. Rather than dropping things off the Leaning Tower, which he probably never did, he just set up some long ramps in his lab and rolled balls down them of various weights. And he would measure how far the balls went in a given amount of time and therefore their speed with something called a water clock. Here's a kind of a schematic drawing of it. The way it worked is you've got a container of water with a hole in the bottom and water's coming out of that hole. You put your finger over the hole, you start the ball rolling when you take your finger off, and then when it gets to a certain distance, you put your finger back on it. You collect the water, and that represents how much time has elapsed. Mm-hmm. And so if it goes twice as far, twice as long, you'll have twice as much water. Really a pretty good idea of how to measure time if you don't have clocks, which he didn't. And what he found was something interesting. First of all, Aristotle was wrong. Regardless of how heavy the balls were, they all rolled down the ramp in the same amount of time. They all went the same speed. But they didn't go that same speed all the way down the ramp. What he found was that in the first unit of time, it would go, let's say, this far, one unit of distance. the first 2 units of time, in 2 seconds, let's say, it would go that far, which is not twice that distance, but 4 times that distance. In the first 3 units of time, it's all the way down here. And if you count up, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 units of distance. Notice what we've got is that in each unit of time, the distance that is traveling is going up the square of that number, 1 to 1, 4 to 2, 3 to 9, the next one would be 16, and it was. It was crude, but it was accurate enough so that he could come out with the laws of science, which kind of contradicted the old classical laws. One interesting thing, I went out and substituted at Greenhill a week or so ago, which I do from time to time, and the 8th grade science class that I was teaching performed essentially this exact same experiment. They didn't use a water clock. They pull out their smartphones and they use that to photograph the thing rolling down the ramp. And an app on their smartphone did all the analysis so that they didn't even have to divide and multiply. But they came up with the same thing Galileo did. Another one he did was you roll a ball down a ramp and across the floor, let's say, and then up another ramp. And what he found was that whatever height he started the ball, it would end up at the same height. It would keep going up that ramp until it got that high again. We now would call that conservation of energy. He didn't have the concept of energy back then. But he knew how this worked. But he found out something that's maybe a little bit surprising, a little bit more important than that. And that is that the other ramp wasn't as steep as the first one. It wouldn't roll the same distance up the ramp, but like I said, it would roll up to the same height. So the shallower that second ramp was, the farther up it the ball would go to reach that height. So then he extrapolated. Remember extrapolating? He extrapolated that if the ramp weren't up at all, if it were perfectly flat, where would the ball go? How far would it have to go to reach that height? Obviously a long way. So what he said was that if you don't make this ball stop for some reason by having it running into something or friction slowing it down or whatever, the ball will just keep doing whatever it's doing. We call that inertia. So Galileo's law of inertia says, left to themselves, things will continue to do what they're doing. If they happen to be at rest, they'll stay there unless you move them. If they happen to be moving, though, they'll keep moving unless you stop them. So one of the first big empirical laws of science, actually a couple of them, go back to Galileo. Kepler came around a little bit after Galileo, and he was a math teacher, an astronomer. He had access to the most accurate astronomical data before the invention of the telescope and the desire to make some sense of it. And he drew on old ideas and attempted to relate the orbital size of the planets, the size of the planet's orbit. And you can see these spheres here. Each one of those represents the orbit of a particular planet, maybe Saturn out here, and Jupiter in there, and Mars in there, and the others are getting kind of too small to see. But these orbits have certain ratios. This one is so much bigger than that one, which is so much bigger than the first one, and so forth. And he wondered, there are 6 planets, and there are 5 platonic solids. Remember the platonic solids, the tetrahedron and the cube and so forth. So suppose that he built a platonic solid, in this case the cube, so that the corners just touch the outermost planet. And just inside that, touching only the faces, the center of the faces, was the next smaller orbit. If you did that, this radius, the size of these orbits you can work out, turns to be about the square root of 2, a little over, not quite 1.5. And that fit reasonably well, but he could do better. Anyway, if you fit the 5 solids among the 6 planets, you know, you run out of solids and planets. That can't just be a coincidence. Scientists don't like coincidences, at least back then they didn't. Every event has a cause, remember. Well, how many ways can you arrange 5 platonic solids? 125. And so he made about 60 of these arrangements, where the biggest thing, in this case, is square or cube, that didn't work very well. Let's make the biggest thing the tetrahedron, the one with the triangular sides in there, and so forth, and get down to the small ones. And after he made, 50 or 60 of these things, none of them fit really well. Some were better than others, but none of them was really a perfect fit.
And he finally decided that as nice an idea as this would have been, as much as he wished it was true, he couldn't make it true. And so he moved on to other things. Here's another different kind of attempt to sort of do the same thing. This is called the Titius Bode Law. A couple of guys that may have come up with it independently, or Bode may have copied Titius, we don't know. You take a series of numbers, n, which is 0 and 3 and 6 and 12 and 24. You see the pattern, I'm doubling it every time. And you add 4 to those numbers, and you divide that result by 10, what you get is this row right here. 0 plus 4 divided by 10 is 0.4. 3 plus 4 divided by 10 is 0.7. You see how that's working. And the interesting thing about that series of numbers is that if you compare that to the radii of the orbits of the planets, which is the bottom row, it's a pretty nice fit. Not exact, and there's some that are a little more off than others. But the Earth, we just made one, because the unit of size in the solar system is what's called the astronomical unit, the distance from the Earth to the Sun. So Venus didn't turn out to be exactly 0.7, it's about 0.72, not quite 0.4. Mars is so-so, Jupiter's perfect, Saturn's not too far off. A couple of problems with this, though, and that is, you've got a gap here. There's no planet at 2.8. And what about all the other numbers out here? If you got this sequence, it goes on forever. Are we wasting all these big numbers out here? Well, right at the beginning of the 19th century, they found a planet right there called Ceres. And they were actually looking for it there because they knew that gap was there. So they were trying to find a planet that moved about the right speed to be that distance away from the Sun. They found one. And whoopee, the Titius Bode Law is great, it works. And within a decade, a guy named William Herschel found another one out here, filled in that gap. Actually, it was probably his sister that found it, but she was a woman, so William Herschel gets credit for it. 1800. So they really thought they were on to something here. And about 60 years, I guess, later, 55 or 60 years later, they found another planet out here. It's called Neptune now. It's the next one out. It should be right at 40, not quite 40 astronomical units out. It turned out to be about 27 or 28. It didn't fit at all. And within about 50 years of that, they found Pluto, another planet out there, and it was something around 30, and it was even farther off. So most people now think this is probably just a coincidence. Just these numbers sort of fit something. And that's one thing that our mind is real good at, that there's something that sort of looks like a pattern, we'll find something that fits it. We do that well, and scientists do it about as well as anybody else. Does that mean that there's some underlying structure? Maybe, maybe not. In this case, probably not. Back to Kepler. Remember Kepler? He had, like I said, access to really good data. And so what he did was plot a real accurate orbit of Earth, and using where the Earth was each of the 365 days, or actually he's had about 1,000 days of several orbits, he plotted where Mars was each of those times. And so he got a real accurate plot of Mars's orbit. And what he found was that he could not make a circle fit that orbit, even if the circle was a little bit off-center, if it didn't center on the Sun. By then, the Sun being the center of the universe was pretty well accepted. Well, he didn't want to give that up because he knew he had the best data there was. He had literally 40 years of data of where Mars was every night, if it wasn't cloudy in Denmark where this astronomer was collecting the Earth. And what he found was that rather than being circular or spherical, the planet's orbits were actually elliptical. He was a geometer, remember. He knew a lot about these conic sections. That's his first law of planetary motion. It was a perfect fit. And when he tried it with the other planets, in every case, he got just a perfect fit, at least as perfect as his data were. Planets' orbits were elliptical, and moreover, the center of that ellipse is not where the Sun is. It's actually at one of the foci. An ellipse has two foci that are kind of in the middle there, but moved out a little, and one of them's got the Sun in it. And that's true for every one of the planets. The Sun is the focus, one of the foci of the orbit. The second law he came up with is how the planets move around the Sun in their orbits, in their elliptical orbits. Well, if they're
Moving in an ellipse, sometimes they're farther away from the sun, sometimes they're closer to the sun. Turns out when they're farther away, they move relatively slowly. When they're closer to the sun, they move relatively rapidly. And so the way he stated that was that there was what he called a constant aerial velocity for each planet. And this picture kind of illustrates what that's talking about. If you pick some... Oops, wrong button. Okay. If you pick a point on the planet's orbits in here pretty close to the sun, it's going to be moving really fast. So in a period of time, say a week, it sweeps out an arc that big. And if you draw the line from the sun to the planet each day, you get this purple kind of rounded triangle here. And if you do the same thing farther out on the orbit, it's not going as fast, but it's farther away. So this is not as big a leg, but these are a little bit bigger because it's farther away from the sun. And as it gets to the farthest point, it's going the slowest, has the longest legs. So if you let this line from the sun to the planet sweep out an area, and this T is the same as that T is the same as that T, all of these areas are going to be exactly the same. An interesting way of stating that it speeds up as it's going toward the sun and slows down when it's going away from it. But given the kind of math that they used for science in those days, geometry, everybody understood what he was talking about. The last one here, he's trying to relate how long it takes the planet to go around the sun, its year, with how far out from the sun it is, the size of its orbit. The farther out it is, the farther it has to go around, so it makes sense that it would take longer. And the farther out it is, the slower it's going, so it makes sense it would take longer. So he tried a lot of ratios. The one-to-one ratio didn't work at all. But he found out if he squared the period and cubed the orbital size, he got a number in this ratio that was the same for all the planets that he knew about. And it's still the same for all the planets. And it even works for things like comets. Anything orbiting the sun, if you take that ratio and square and cube it, you get that same number. This is another example of what's called an empirical law of science. It's based totally on the fact that he had real good data to work with, and he found a pattern that fit that data. That's an empirical law. Isaac Newton came along and sort of worked at it from the other direction. Newton was more of a theoretician. He had a lab. He did laboratory kind of stuff, but he mainly thought about things. I'm getting way ahead of myself here. Scientific laws are a form of model that they're either deduced from some theory or they're induced from some experiments or some combination of those. They usually are stated as simply and specifically as possible, often mathematically, as Newton did, you're going to see here in a minute. So from Galileo's experiments about inertia, remember things will continue to go at the same speed unless you speed them up or slow them down with some kind of a force. Newton's made his first law of motion, which is if the force on an object is zero, its velocity will be constant. That's the law of inertia stated a little bit more precisely, I guess. The second one says that if the force is not zero, if you apply a force to something, it'll speed up or slow down. The velocity will change, and the way Newton said it was that its momentum, mass times velocity, will change. If the force varies, this becomes a little bit hard to calculate. And so in order to make the calculation of his second law with a force that varied from time to time or place to place, he invented something called calculus. And this one I've just written as a calculus equation, a differential equation. That's the way Newton would have written it. The third law is law of symmetry. Scientists love symmetries. And what it says is that forces are always interactions between bodies. And they necessarily, therefore, must affect both of the bodies. So the way he said it was, if you have some force of body one on body two, that's got to be equal to and opposite to the force that body two applies back to body one. It's got to be the same kind of force. It's got to be the same amount of force. But it's applied to the other object in the opposite direction. So if something runs into something this way and bounces back, this one's got to move that way. The way Newton said it was, for every action, there's an equal opposite reaction. The last law that Newton came up with, the law of gravity, bothered him a bit because it was an example of something called action at a distance. He refused to speculate how force could be applied without some kind of contact. But he had already been working for a while with optics and light. And optics, light, is also, in a sense, action at distance, because the light that I'm seeing back there comes to my eyes through space. How does it get here? And more specifically, as it comes through from there to here, how does it change? And what Newton knew, and what most of us know, is that the farther away from a light you are, the dimmer it is. In fact, it goes down with the square of the distance. If I move twice as far away from a light, it becomes 1/4 as bright, 3 times 1/9 as bright. And so Newton reckoned that since gravity also operates through space, it must act in some way similar to what light does traveling through space. And that's where you get this inverse square on the end of the equation. So the force of gravity between two objects depends on both of their masses, how heavy each one of them is, and how far apart they are. And this is simply a constant that makes the units come out right. It's one of the constants of nature that I'll talk about. Theory of evolution by natural selection is also broad and powerful. Newton's laws of motion together comprise what we call a scientific theory, the broadest, most powerful model there is in science, the most inclusive model there is in science as a theory. This is another theory, the theory of evolution. I know it's called a theory of evolution, except the Republicans want to call it, it's called a law, but the Republicans want to call it a theory because they think theories are just something, you know, nobody really believes, that you just make up. Well, that's not what it is in science. So the theory of evolution by natural selection is broad, a broad, powerful theory. It underlies most of the current life sciences, including medicine. This model, which is quite a bit more elaborate than the one that Darwin would have drawn, is based not only on morphology and on fossil evidence, but also on molecular evidence. We now know what's related to what and how closely by looking at their DNA and comparing things on a microscopic basis. So we know a lot better what's related to what than Darwin did with his finches and crabs and clams and stuff that he worked with. But laying out the theory in his Origin of Species, he was careful to point out its weakness. In other words, he would say, as he's laying out his theory, what would it take to make me believe this theory's not true? What's the weakness in his theory? And he was able to show in each one of those cases that the simplest explanation for the appearance of traits came from his evolutionary theory. And so this is kind of like Popper's law, the falsifiability of scientific theories. All right. Getting a little bit more mathematical now. I know you're glad to see that. James Maxwell was working at about the same time as Darwin, and he developed some statistical representations of huge numbers of free particles like a container of gas. There's millions of gas particles in that container. How do you deal with all of those interactions? You obviously can't. And so what he did was deal with it the way we deal with large numbers now. He used statistics. He developed a lot of the statistics that we do now. This model shows the distribution of speeds of these gas molecules at different temperatures. So for example, at minus 100 Celsius, all the gas molecules would fall under this red curve. So you've got a spread of some slow ones and some medians and some fast ones. These are meters per second. So the very fast ones, fastest, are a little over 800 meters a second, moving right along. Average is somewhere around 300. As you heat up the gas, according to these statistics, what happened was that the fastest molecules would move fastest, and there would be more of them moving faster. The average would also go up. Notice that at 20 Celsius, we got an average around 400. So the average molecule is going faster and the spread is broader. At really high temperatures, 600 Celsius, you've got a lot of fast molecules and an average, what would that be, not quite 700 meters per second. So this is a statistical law, and it was able to describe a lot of things we knew about gases, like why did their pressure go up. The law, which this equation by here describes all of those curves, and any one you want to put in there, just put a different value for T, came from Newton's ideas about force and momentum and energy, and Newton would have recognized everything that Maxwell did here. Much of the physical science in the last century and a half has been an effort to unify seemingly disparate branches of science. And what Newton did here was to unify mechanics, how things interact, how particles interact with each other, and heat, which were before that two completely different branches of science. Maxwell also produced four equations that unified some other branches of science. Here they are. These are based on earlier work that people like Gauss and Faraday and Ampere had done. And these are often, these equations are good enough that you see them on t-shirts and bumper stickers if you go around a university. They're considered by many of us to be the most beautiful equations in all of science. And if you haven't had the pleasure, I'm going to take a little bit of time to sort of explain to you what each one says, in case you're not familiar with the integral calculus. The first one says that if you have an electric field going through the surface of some closed area, a box of some kind, it doesn't have to be a physical box, it could be imaginary, but if you have all the electric field lines going through that, they depend only on how much charge, Q, that box contains. This little constant down here is called permittivity. It's one of the naturally occurring constants. It's fairly easy to measure and calculate. So electric fields are caused by electric charge. No big surprise. This just kind of quantifies it. The second one says that magnetic field going through some kind of a closed box is zero. Well, what that implies is that there's nothing magnetically equivalent to electric charge. There are no magnetic monopoles. And anytime you have a magnetic field coming out of the box, you must have somewhere else a magnetic field line equivalent to it going into the box so that the lines go through the box, but none of them start and end inside the box. Well, if you don't have anything like a monopole causing a magnetic field, where does it come from? And the last two equations explain that. This one says if you have a loop of some kind, like a piece of wire that you twist the ends together, and you measure the electric field around that loop, it depends on how strongly the magnetic field that goes through the loop is changing. So you can make an electrical current by changing a magnetic field. This is the principle on which generators work. The last one says the same thing for magnetism. If you have a loop, like a loop of wire, and a magnetic field going around that loop, that depends only on how fast the electrical field through the loop changes. And one other thing, which since you have electric charges, they might be moving through the loop, and that's called current. Again, you have this little constant out here. One of the more interesting things about that is you have another constant that appears over here. It's called permeability. It's easy to be measured and calculated. And if you multiply those two constants together, like this equation does, it turns out to equal the speed of light. Now, why in the world, what in the world does electrical and magnetic fields have to do with light? And Maxwell made this intellectual leap that light must be an electrical and magnetic field generating each other moving through space. And it happens to be the frequency, the generation frequency, is one that we happen to be able to see. Just like we can hear certain sounds, we can hear certain frequencies, we can see certain frequencies of electromagnetism. And he said, there's probably others that we can't see, and that led to the discovery of things like radio and X-rays and ultraviolet and the forms of electromagnetic radiation we can't see. This unifies the sciences of electricity, magnetism, and light. So Maxwell's feeling pretty good about himself. He's unified mechanics, heat, electricity, magnetism, light, energy, all this stuff. What's left? And here's a quote from Maxwell. Basically, he said, it's all done now. All the major work is over with. And this is in the late 1800s that he's saying this. The only occupation left in mental science will be to carry these measurements out to another decimal place. Not much later than that, Lord Kelvin, who also studied a lot about heat, said essentially the same thing. From time to time, after discovering what appear to be fundamentals in reality, scientists are wont to declare the nearing end of discovery. This has happened again recently with the discovery of the long-predicted Higgs boson, which is a particle thought by some to be the ultimate subatomic particle. Leon Lederman calls it the God particle. That makes the other particles tangible and it's the last thing that we need to find. Now we understand everything about subatomic particles. Niels Bohr was a young man about that time, one of the architects of what came to be known as quantum mechanics. For a time, the atom had been discovered by then. For a time, Bohr imagined that an atom was like a little solar system with this massive nucleus like the sun, and the electrons like the planets going in their kind of weird wavy orbits around it. It soon became clear that this model didn't correspond very well with the known characteristics of atoms and electrons. And Bohr, to his credit, was willing to abandon it for more complex, less intuitive models, which we'll get to here. There are many types of waves. There's ocean waves that move the surface of the ocean. There's sound waves that move air molecules back and forth. There's fan waves in the stadiums where people jump up and down. All of these waves require a medium of something, something to wiggle. So the question is, light goes through space, what does it wave? What's the medium? For some time, space was thought to be filled with a strange substance that they called ether. Kind of goes back to the quintessence idea the Greeks had. This model, in order to carry light, though, had to have some kind of incompatible properties. For example, it had to be extremely thin because the planets can move through it. It doesn't slow them down or anything. And since the rigidity of a medium determines how fast light waves go through it, light goes faster in water than air and faster in ice than water. So light, being the fastest wave, had to travel through a really rigid medium. So you have this substance that's really fluid so we can get through it easily and really rigid. It's kind of hard to visualize what kind of substance that would be. Toward the end of the 19th century, scientists were making increasingly accurate measurements of the speed of light in their labs. The speed of light, in fact, is now known exactly because we've defined it as one of the fundamental constants of science. So we've pinned it down. We know it to something like 9 digits, and that's all it is. It'll never change. If we discover that it wasn't what we thought it was, what will change is how long a second is or how long a meter is. Those are now derived quantities from the speed of light. Kind of makes sense. For one thing, light's pretty easy to measure accurately. All right, so if the Earth is not the stationary center of the universe, then labs have to be moving through space. And they could measure light in different directions and different times to determine how fast the Earth is moving through space. And what their measurements implied was the Earth wasn't moving after all. Something must be wrong with the paradigm of motion they'd held since Galileo. And a young patent clerk showed them how we could do without long-held concepts of ether and absolute space and uniform time. Space, time, motion, matter, energy are all bound together in simple but counterintuitive ways. I don't know if that's very intuitive, but that's the way they're bound together. And what this says, for example, is that two clocks moving relative to each other will measure different amount of times between the same two events. That's the top equation there. If you have engineers on two trains moving relative to each other, each one will think the other's train is shorter than his, and it's not just ego. That's what they would actually measure. We never noticed this effect previously because most trains move too slowly for gamma, which is this little term right here, which is that, to be significantly different than one. Gamma is the square, the square of the speed of light divided into the square of the speed the things are going, subtracted from 1, well, if V is pretty small compared to C, C, by the way, is 186,000 miles, which is almost the distance of the sun every second. So if V is pretty small compared to that, then what you got under here is practically 1. You take the square root of that, it's even closer to 1. You take the reciprocal of it, and it's still real close to 1. So gamma is almost always 1 in anything we're familiar with. We never noticed this effect because trains move too slowly for gamma to be different than 1. The effects only start showing up at around 10% the speed of light. We also had not noticed before Einstein that it should be possible to get a huge amount of energy from a tiny amount of mass. Same equation you're familiar with here. C squared, again, is 9 times 10 to the 16th in metric units. A big number. So a little bit of mass could be turned into a huge amount of energy, which unfortunately we do from time to time. Going back at least to Newton, scientists have argued whether light might be composed of tiny bullets instead of waving ether. The measurement of light's wavelength seemed for a while to settle the argument until Einstein threw another spanner in the works. His model is something called the photoelectric effect, which is responsible for things like solar cells. Had light beams composed of tiny energetic packets called quanta eventually, or photons, which they stayed intact until they were absorbed by something like an atom. These quantas were particles. In other words, they had particle-like properties, like a particular place in space and momentum that could knock things around. You can push stuff with light. Well, just as scientists, oh, by the way, this photoelectric effect article, which he published in 1905, got him his Nobel Prize, so it was a fairly important break with previous science. Anyway, as scientists were getting to get their heads around this idea that light's a particle, a young man named de Broglie came along, and he proposed and later confirmed that tiny particles we call electrons could sometimes act like waves. They could have wavelength. And everything, we realize, sometimes act like particles and sometimes acts like waves. Something's wrong with our common sense models. In fact, the 20th century essentially led scientists to abandon common sense in surprising areas. Our common sense notions do fit very well at the scale of human size and speed. But when we try to fit them into the very small, like atoms, or the very large, like galaxies, the very hot, like nuclear explosions, or the very fast, up close to light speed, the poor fit and the incorrect predictions remind us that models should not be extended too far. Ordinary written and spoken languages are less and less capable of describing objects and events on these inhuman scales. And the language of higher mathematics is becoming our only way to model them. Relatively few people are fluent in math, and our ability to translate math to, say, English is limited. We're reminded again that we shouldn't focus on the finger, or the glory of nature will escape our notice. Einstein's general theory of relativity, the supermodel on the first slide, if you didn't recognize it, predicted something odd. The universe couldn't be stable. It had to be expanding or contracting. And nobody at the time thought it was doing either one. So Einstein introduced something called a cosmological constant, a fudge factor, into the equations to counteract gravity. Within a very few years, Edwin Hubble, the Hubble telescope's named after him, at the Mount Wilson Observatory in California, measured the light coming from distant galaxies, and he was surprised to find that they're all receding from us. They're all going away. The universe is, in fact, expanding, and the cosmological constant was unnecessary. Einstein, when he learned of that, called it his greatest blunder. Working backwards from Hubble's discovery, a physicist named George Gamow speculated that in the distant past, the universe must have been much smaller and hotter and denser. And billions of years before the sun was born, it must have had a beginning, which he called the Big Bang. Since that time, astronomers using the Big Bang model and Hubble's law of expansion, which is given by this line here, have just been trying to pin down how old the universe really is. In other words, they're adding another decimal place to their measurements again. The latest figure using this value for Hubble's constant is about 13.7 billion years ago is when all that started. All right, an expanding universe influenced by the attractive force of gravity suggests three possibilities. If it's thin enough and expanding fast enough, it'll expand forever. Everything beyond our local neighborhood will be too far away to see. That's the top red line there. If it's expanding slightly slower and has a bit more density, that it'll expand, but the expansion will approach zero. This will flatten out until the last stars run out of fuel, and then we won't see them anymore. Finally, if you've got enough mass, the expansion will eventually stop, and matter will start falling back down, and that'll result in the big crunch here. Careful measurements in the last half of the 20th century showed there was far more mass than the stars and planets and gas and dust that we can see in the universe. As yet, we don't know what it is, what all this unseen dark matter is, but there's a lot of it. There's maybe five times as much as the matter we can detect. It doesn't appear, however, that even with the dark matter, there's enough to stop the expansion. So it looks like one of these top two lines is what we have to look forward to. Careful measurements in the 1990s, however, which have been confirmed by other measurements since, showed us something kind of surprising. This is one that you've probably seen before. When astronomers measure the rate at which extremely old and distant galaxies, the one way back in time and way far away, they found to their astonishment that the rate of expansion is not slowing down at all. In fact, it seems to be accelerating. This implies there's something about space-time that's equivalent to Einstein's cosmological constant, which counters gravity and pushes the universe apart. We call this effect dark energy, but that just means we don't understand it. We don't yet know what it is, how it acts, or what the distant future holds. So once again, just when we thought we had good models to describe nature, nature throws us a spitball. Whatever the immediate future has in store for the evolution of science, it looks like another paradigm shift may be waiting for discovery. Here's some questions that need to be answered to see where that will go. What is this dark matter that we found? Does dark energy even exist? If so, how does it act? Do the values of natural constants show an underlying structure? This is an interesting, there's about 12 numbers that describe all of our science. The speed of light is one of them. The charge on an electron is one of them. Things like that. And if these numbers were slightly different than what they are, we wouldn't be here because atoms couldn't exist, or carbon atoms couldn't exist, or stars couldn't exist. So are these values the way they are for some reason that causes us to be here? Or is the fact that we're here just means that's the way the values are? Are there other fundamental particles? After scientists start to figure out they've discovered all the particles, others came along and say, no, there are some supersymmetric particles. Some names they've given are squarks, which is supersymmetric quarks, if you know what quarks are. Photinos are supersymmetric photons. Wimps and machos are ideas that people have put up for what this dark matter is made of. Weakly interactive massive particles. The weirdest one is strings, which are tiny, tiny, tiny little pieces of energy or something that wiggles real fast. And they're millions of millions of millions of times smaller than atoms, which means no detector that we can conceive of will ever detect these things. But maybe they are why there are electrons that have the properties they do. We don't know. I just hope I live to see the next paradigm shift. Thank you, and I'll try to answer the questions that you may have. Yes, ma'am.
I actually have two questions, but
okay.
I'll see if I can at least one. In March, in CERN, Switzerland, they're going to be turning on the Large Hadron Collider.
Right, they've souped it up.
More powerful than before. And I wanted to find out, outside of just playing with black holes,
it's on, Dave.
What do you really think their purpose?
This list of particles that I got down here are too energetic for any of the accelerators that we have so far to detect. So one of the things they want to do is, first of all, confirm the Higgs boson. It was at the upper limit of what they could do before. And then they want to start looking for some of these supersymmetric particles. Now, an obvious question is, why? If these things only exist in temperatures like the center of a star, or in particles are in space that are so energetic that it's like the center of a galaxy, what good are they for us? Could we spend that money giving everybody milk or literacy? And that's an excellent question. The thing is, people are curious. The way we've gotten to where we are now is our curiosity. We want to find out how things work. And it's gotten to the point that in order to find out something new, you got to spend a lot of money. And so it's the curiosity that's driving this. And businesses are willing to put money into it because the photoelectric effect, which when Einstein came up with it, nobody thought that meant anything. You know, it's a good theory, but so what? Well, all of our electronics now depend on that. Relativity, GPS wouldn't work without understanding general relativity, that supermodel equation.
Well, that kind of leads to my second question.
Good.
Just like Pandora's box, with this collider being so large, and then playing with energy, is that we've never experimented with before. Is there an ethical limit to where they have a law where they will stop? I mean,
that's a great question, and that's a different lecture. I've heard that one. I've given that one, but it would take so long to explore that all I can say right now, I guess, is that scientists will show you how things work. What you do with them depends on your ethics. So discovering nuclear energy, for example, supposedly for a while was supposed to solve all our energy problems. At the same time, it obliterated a couple of cities. Was Albert Einstein responsible for that? Well, some would say, yeah, he was, because he was the first one that said, we can do this kind of thing.
Well, they know, though, that they could destroy our planet, right?
No, they don't. In fact, they've done calculations, and at the temperature that the CERN collider is going to work at for the foreseeable future, it's not energetic enough even to create what they call these microscopic black holes. It doesn't have quite enough to end it all.
Yeah. There's another lecture for that.
Yeah.
Given what you said about Maxwell's hubris, and later on I believe Niels Bohr said that the atom can never be split, things like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Carl, because you referenced Karl Popper and the idea of refutable hypotheses, and I think most people would say he's almost like the last word on how you do scientific method, but
yeah.
Do you think that maybe Karl Popper's insights on the refutable hypothesis notion, that those ideas themselves might eventually start being chalked away at, or maybe you even think that there's good examples of where there's limits to what he said. Anyway, I'm curious about your opinions on Popper.
Well, Popper, what he was trying to do, I think, was, here's, if you have a philosophy, how do you know if it's a scientific philosophy or not? And as I understand it, what he was saying was, if your philosophy is truly scientific, that it must be based on reality, on experience, on experiment, on something that you can actually see, hear, smell, taste, measure in some way. And if it's not that, then it's, how can I say this nicely?
High in the sky.
Yeah. It's not exactly science anymore. It's more like masturbation. Okay, that's a nice way of saying what I was going to say. Yeah. Philosophers can do that. They can come up with all kind of theories, and the theories may be internally consistent. Are they true? Well, I don't know if there's any philosopher that would say, yes, I can prove this philosophical theory is true. A mathematician might say that, but not a philosopher. So Popper's simply trying to create a demarcation between what he considers scientific, and that is that if I'm going to propose a scientific theory, and you can produce this data that theory might predict, then it must be false.
Right. I'm just asking you, in the same way that you had Maxwell saying, oh, this is it, and then you had Niels Bohr saying, this is it, and all these guys these days saying, my cosmological theory of superstring theory is it, that maybe even Popper's insights on how you do scientific method
might be
chalked away at it.
In the last 10 years, there have been the end of physics, I've read, the end of nature, and the end of science. I mean, there's a lot of that stuff around now. Are we right this time? I don't think so. There's just too many things we don't know, and there's too many things that just will not fit into our big framework of what we do understand. I hope not, I'll have to say.
This is a really specific question.
Good.
I read in a book one time that if you shoot a photon with a photon gun through a cesium gas chamber and measure when it enters and when it exits, that it exits before it enters.
I haven't heard of that exact experiment. If you shoot a photon through anything, it slows down. Light goes through glass slower than it does through air, slower than it does through a vacuum. There was an experiment, it's been about 5 years ago, I think, in Italy, where they essentially did that. They created high-energy neutrinos, which also move at about the speed of light, in a reactor in some place in Italy, and then
someplace in Switzerland, they detected these particles. And according to the measurements they were making, they detected them just before they're created in Italy. Now, that's probably the one you're referring to. That one has essentially been debunked. The way they were measuring those two events turned out to have some flaws. Because you're talking about a tiny, tiny amount of time at two widely separated places. It's hard to measure, and we think their measurements were off. We still are fairly convinced that cause precedes effect. When it doesn't, then the philosophers have something to worry about.
Questions?
Y'all are easy on me. My eighth graders wouldn't let me get away with this much.
If not, thank you, Dr. Kimmer.
Okay. All right.